Sharai, the podcast, co-hosted by the Governance Program at the Aga Khan University and
the International Society for Islamic Legal Studies, in cooperation with the University of Bern. Welcome to a new episode of Sharai, the podcast. My name is Serena Tolino.
And my name is Gianluca Parolin.
And we have today with us Sebastian Ezesser from the University of Kiel.
Welcome, Sebastian.
Hi, and thank you for inviting me.
What do you like to do in your free time, Sebastian?
I could mention a number of things, but one hobby of mine that I discussed recently also at an online meeting was city walking. Actually, I didn't know that it was a legitimate hobby, like a thing that people, but someone else said, I do that. And then I noticed, actually, I do that too. So when I'm in Cairo, for example, I just love to walk around and look at, discover new neighborhoods that I haven't seen before. Maybe also head to interesting buildings or sometimes restaurants.
I think that in Cairo, the risk is a city tripping rather than city walking. do you have any plan for city walking in London then?
Actually, I was in London about a few years ago doing field work and interviews mostly, and the interviews weren't really going very well. So I had a lot of time on my hands and I walked around quite a lot. So I don't have any plans for the next stay. Maybe the East End, you know, Indian quarters of the East End. But it's in London, everything's rather unspectacular, so no big plans.
Well, you need to watch the series EastEnders before visiting the area then. That's my recommendation. Okay. That's a must in British culture. Popular culture, of course.
And Sebastian, what have you been working on mostly in your career and especially more recently?
Yeah, my first main research was on Coptic Christians in contemporary Egypt. That was in the 2000s, so the late Mubarak years. And that led to my PhD and a book about the Coptic question in the Mubarak era. After that, I turned to more to Islamism, which had been also an important subject already in my master thesis when I studied. And so for the past 10 years, but I've been looking into especially the ideological development of the Muslim Brotherhood. So I managed to collect a lot of source material from the time when before the repression of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. And I've been mostly working with these sources from inside the Muslim Brotherhood about their own ideology, about their ideas of Dawah. And Tarbiyah, and of course, within this material, you have a lot of fiqh questions coming up. And that's basically why I applied to join also the Islamic Legal Studies Conference, because there are really some things I'd like to discuss these things with people who are specialists in Islamic law. And as you know, people who work about Islamism are mostly not very knowledgeable about Islamic law and yeah.
Recently, you have edited a special issue of Asiatische Studien et études asiatiques on the formation of modern Muslim subjectivity. And so I wonder if you could tell us a bit more about the entire edited issue or special issue and also your contribution to it. And since you mentioned fiqh, what role it plays?
The whole issue was sort of the result of a series of workshops I did together with some colleagues, mostly from Northern Germany and Denmark. And we chose this subjectivities as an sort of overarching theme. And we had different people mostly working with interviews or fieldwork-based approaches and trying to get into this question of Muslim subjectivities. It's a somewhat theoretical it's sort of a bird's eye view in a way, and I'm always a little skeptical about the results, even if you say Muslim subjectivities, but also trying to pin down the subjectivity of someone or the subjectivity that you find in a discourse or you find in fieldwork. It's difficult. I'm still not totally convinced, but still I'd like to invite our listeners to to read the the special issue. My contribution was about the Muslim Brotherhood, and because a lot of the books I read in the Muslim Brotherhood bookshops were about education, my aim was to find out what are the educational aims of the Muslim Brotherhood. What are they trying to do with people? You know, how are they trying to educate them, to form them, to shape them, socialize them? And yeah, that's basically the topic of my article, and one of the main arguments of the article, that you can't take the theory at face value. Muslim Brothers saying that they are producing, you know, the perfect virtuous Muslims, it doesn't work that way for several reasons, because there are so many aims that you're trying to fulfill, that it's just not, you have to have certain priorities, and you can find different stances within the Muslim Brotherhood. And some things are just not educational aims that you have. It's not possible to put them into practice right away. And I was actually using sources from Muslim Brothers themselves, reflecting on why this education thing isn't really working out. That's the interesting thing, that themselves, they sort of have second thoughts about it sometimes. Does it have to do with fiqh, was your question? I'm not sure.
You do cover it in your main piece.
There, oh, do I? Well, I guess it depends on how broadly you define fiqh. Of course, where did you find it in my paper?
Well, when you look at how the discourse of fiqh is mobilized, and you challenge the depth of references to fiqh.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, with the Muslim Brotherhood, and you always have this reference to fiqh is sort of important to them, because they're always claiming that their Islam is the, you know, the Islamic tradition written large. And you find that in fiqh, in, you know, the old classics, and that is the view of Islam on life and on things. And that's the same as we as Muslim Brothers are saying. So it's very important as a legitimizing tool, but actually they have their own language, which is an ideological language and which is not rooted in fiqh. So one of the things I'm grappling with, and also I'm trying to go into in my presentation at the conference, is how even we can distinguish some way between fiqh and ideological Islam. Is it possible even to make a distinction? And how can we analyze this sort of dualism or often ambiguity between arguing with bringing in fiqh arguments, and then on the other hand, you also have tactical arguments or strategical, you know, for the da'wah, we have to do this or that. And all of a sudden, it doesn't matter whether there is legal injunction to the contrary. That's the, you know, subject I'm trying to get into.
Sebastian, one of the aspects I really liked a lot in the article you shared with us was the tension that you identified in your sources between the relevance of a balance between a successful personal life and the role of Muslim Brothers as activists. And I know that also in other occasions you presented and you worked a lot on manuals, for example, on marriage, on happiness in family life, and so on. So I wonder, could you tell us something more about that, maybe?
Well, obviously, there is a huge bulk of literature on especially the women in Islam within the Muslim Brotherhood. One interesting thing I noticed, that from like recent years, you also get this advice literature, which is really similar to marriage advice literature from a Anglo-Saxon provenance. And I mean, it's part of, you could say, like a global phenomenon of advice, life advice for people who want to be happy, successful, and stuff like that, you know, also within a context of a capitalist economy and so on and so forth, except for, you know, like this treatment on one or two pages in this article. I feel that if I really want to interpret this literature, I have to talk with people. That's one of my main ambitions, to somehow get the money to do some field work, to talk with real people and to see how they understand these books, how they, because if you don't have a context, if you don't have a social context, it's really difficult to interpret it. And I'm really hesitant to say the Muslim Brothers, for them, the women has this or that role, because you also have to see, you know, there's the theory and then there's the thing that people do in real life, and you have to have this real life dimension too. So I pointed out some interesting, let's say, comments I found in the literature, but that's really a broad survey, and yeah, I'd like to get more into that, but haven't been able to.
At the conference, you will be looking especially at patterns of the use of fiqh, you say, in an ideological context. So how did you identify these patterns, and why do you think that these patterns are useful?
Well, I noticed them mainly by looking at sort of collection of similar texts. So Muslim Brothers, like in sort of, you could say, programmatic literature, like the things they write for internal use, to sum up the teachings of the Muslim Brotherhood. And in many of them, you find, or sum up the teachings of Hassan al-Banna. And there you find chapters on different stuff, for example, on takfir. And I compared them and I tried to, you know, find the commonalities and the differences. Then, of course, I sort of asked myself, how can I explain the differences? Why does this author not mention a certain aspect of takfir, for example, that the Muslim Brotherhood is actually not rejecting takfir on principle, but only takfir of certain people, only takfir of the rulers and takfir of the ummah as a whole, but takfir of people who say things that are contrary to the teaching of Islam is pretty much endorsed by the main people in the 1970s. And for example, some later sources just don't mention this aspect. And then when, that's one example, the other examples, when quoting big authorities, there's also a process of selection and also of interpretation. One concept that's really interesting in this context is ma'lum min ad-din daruratan, what the things that are, how do you say that in English? By default, known from religion. And of course, it's a very vague concept, but which is used widely in traditional fiqh treatises. And then you have to come up with definitions. I mean, who are the people who is it the ulama? What the ulama would know, or what the common people would know about Islam? And you have, I mean, depending on how you interpret this, you come to very different conclusions, of course. I mean, you could still, on the basis of this, excommunicate maybe, you know, a lot of people, or you could try to interpret it in a very restrictive way.
Thank you a lot, Sebastian. We are looking forward to listening to this paper in London and hope to see you there.
Thank you, Sebastian.
Thank you.